Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Eden. And Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch. And he built a city and called the name of the city after the name of his son Enoch. Down to verse 19. Then Lamech took for himself two wives. The name of one was Adah, and the name of the second was Zilhah. And Adah bore Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the harp and flute. As for Zilhah, she also bore Tubal-Cain, an instructor of every craftsman in bronze and iron. And the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. And then over to chapter 6, verse 5. Then the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Verse 12. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. And then God gives to Noah all the instructions for the construction of the ark. So, as I say, we've been looking at the age before the flood, and we've been trying to gain an understanding of what the world was like, what life was like in the period before the flood. And of course, one of the reasons that we're interested in this, certainly I'm interested in this, is because of what Jesus says there in Luke's Gospel in chapter 17. And verse 26, Jesus said, as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be also in the days of the Son of Man. They ate, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and the flood came and destroyed them all. Likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot. They ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even so will it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. So, in other words, what we can expect to see is that the sort of things that were happening in the days, the period before the flood, will be repeated again in the earth. They'll be repeated again amongst people in that time leading up to the second coming of the Lord Jesus Christ. And as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. And I think, as I pointed out last time in our last Bible study, that doesn't mean that the days of Noah began when the flood came. It doesn't mean the days of Noah began when he started building the ark. The days of Noah include the whole period leading up to the flood. And of course, Noah was 600 years old when the flood came. So I put it to you, the days of Noah are at least the period of his life. So it's a long period leading up to the time when God judged the earth through the flood. And so when God sent the flood, clearly sin and wickedness had kind of reached a peak just before the judgment was poured out upon the earth. Nevertheless, that didn't happen all at once. It happened over a long period of time, where one generation grew worse than the one before. Each generation pushed the boundaries a little bit further, so that as time went by, sin and wickedness and evil increased over that whole period of time. Even though there was this godly remnant of true faithful believers who continued to preach righteousness, who continued to preach the gospel, they were, and the nearer the time of the flood came, actually the numbers of that godly remnant were dwindling. But nevertheless, they continued to preach and to show forth the testimony of God in an age of increasing wickedness, until the judgment came. So it will be in the days of the Son of Man. In other words, there'll come a time when sin will, as it were, reach a whole new level. Sin will reach a peak. Now, it's impossible for you and I to know when sin and wickedness has reached its peak, at the point in which God will send judgment. It's impossible for us to view that. All I know is that in my 61 years, I've seen things wax worse. I think we were saying the other week, you know, you see some things on the news today. And I remember, I was very young at the time, but I remember it probably because it's been mentioned so many times since. And it became one of the infamous crimes of the 20th century, the Ian Brady and Moira Hindley murders. And that just rocked the nation. The wickedness of what they did rocked the nation to the point where it's still remembered clearly today. But I put it to you that those sort of crimes happen so frequently now that they're often barely mentioned. They often don't even get in the newspaper, let alone the front page, do they? Why is that? It's because sin and wickedness have increased. You know, and so we see things getting worse and worse and worse. I'm not trying to be negative, I'm trying to be realistic. We see things getting worse and worse, but we've still no way of knowing when sin has actually reached its peak. But it will do. And when it does, God will pour out judgment on this earth again. Not in the same way that he did in the days of Noah, but he will. In the meantime, the true faithful believers continue to preach the true gospel and continue to show forth the love of Christ and the testimony of Christ in the life. But if it's like it was in the days of Noah, the number of the true faithful will dwindle. Because as in the days of Noah, so shall it be. The numbers will perhaps dwindle. And then he will come at a time when the godly remnant of true believers who remain faithful to him and continue to preach and testify to the true gospel will perhaps be few on the earth. And again, I'm not being negative. When I was preparing this Bible study, I was reminded of something Jesus said also in Luke's gospel. And that in chapter 18, Jesus said in verse 8, I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth? Will he really find faith on the earth? Open question. You know, and to me, that kind of is the opposite of what is so often suggested today, that before Jesus comes, there's going to be such a worldwide revival that, you know, masses and masses of, you know, people will be ushered into the kingdom. All of a sudden, then Jesus will come. It's called post-millennial triumphalism. But Jesus says, when the Son of Man returns, will he find the true faith on the earth? Question. And so I put it to you that the true faith will perhaps be a dwindling number. Then Jesus will return. Now, you'll recall last time we were thinking about the religion and spirituality of the pre-flood era. So this evening, I want us to think about the intelligence, the knowledge the people of the pre-flood era had, and consider something of actually the technologies that they must have possessed. Okay, and I'm going to base this Bible study on things that the Bible says and what we must conclude from those things, and also from certain things that exist in the world today that date right back to the period, if not before the flood, certainly shortly after it. Things that still exist in the world today that, because of the very nature of these things, they absolutely baffle those who look at them, and are evidences of high intelligence, to the point where, because modern man cannot believe that ancient human beings could have possessed such knowledge, they come out with all sorts of bizarre theories, like that was done by extraterrestrials or something like that. And the reason for that, as I want to show tonight, is because the evidence is staring them in the face. But it doesn't fit in with their worldview, which is based on an evolutionary model. And the point is, you see, that our worldview is extremely important because it affects how we look at everything. If you have a biblical worldview, then that affects how you see everything. If you have, well, an evolutionary worldview, that affects how you see everything. John Mackay, who was here last week, would say this, and in fact every creationist teacher would say the same thing. The fossils that we look at, the fossils that the creationist looks at, and the fossil evidence that the evolutionist looks at are exactly the same. It's how you interpret the evidence, and it's what your worldview is that determines what you conclude from that evidence, you see. So, obviously, if we're talking about the period before the flood, and we're talking about archaeological finds and things that have been dug up or whatever from that period, then from ancient history, then obviously there is very little that exists from the pre-flood era, for obvious reasons. The flood wasn't, you know, a bit of bad rain like for 40 days or 150 days or whatever it was. You know, it was infinitely worse than that. It included earthquakes, tsunamis, tidal waves, absolutely ripping, you know, the whole earth apart. And, you know, it was a deluge of enormous proportions. So therefore, whatever was before the flood, most if not all of it, is absolutely wiped away, you know, washed away or covered deep in the earth. So obviously not much remains from before the flood, if anything. Although, if you go off the dates, and I'm sorry, some of this is history tonight, and it might be partly because I'm a bit of a geek, you know, that I'm interested in some of these things, but there is a purpose to it, you see, as I'll come to when we finish. If you base your view on what archaeologists and historians say, the date of the building of the Great Pyramid of Giza is, then if their dates are correct, that would predate the flood. If their dates are correct, okay, it would predate the flood. I'll tell you what the dates are in a bit. So perhaps the Great Pyramid of Giza is one ancient artifact that does predate the flood. And the thing about the Great Pyramid of Giza is, they cannot understand how that was built. Even today, with all our knowledge and with all our computers and with everything else we've got, they cannot work it out how that was done. Neither do they know what it was for. So if you go on the internet or you look at books, there's all kinds of theories. You know, and it's actually a fascinating subject, is the Great Pyramid of Giza. But the point is, they don't understand how it was done. Even today. So I'm basing what we do tonight on what we can deduce from what the Bible tells us, together with evidence from certain archaeological objects or artifacts that actually support the biblical view. As a matter of fact, they support it. Academia would say otherwise, but they're wrong. It actually supports what the Bible is saying, as I hope to show. And of course, what is taught in the classroom today, from kindergarten right up to university level and beyond, academia generally, actually runs contrary to what the Bible teaches. Because it's based, you see, on a completely different worldview, a completely different opinion. See, the Bible teaches that the human race began around 6,000 years ago. That's it. Around 6,000 years ago, the human race began with one man and one woman who had been created by God. God created the man directly and then created the woman from a rib that he took out of the side of man. And so that first couple, that first man and woman, were created by God, perfect and upright in the image of God. We've looked at all this in previous Bible studies. And they had incredible intelligence. They weren't created like you know, numbskulls who had to start in the classroom from day one with you know, abs and takeaways or what. I mean, they had incredible intelligence from the word go. And they were taught by the Lord himself, who has knowledge of all things. So the first couple were highly intelligent individuals. Now, of course, because of the fall, and through the fall, their intelligence became, their knowledge and their understanding became somewhat warped and corrupted. Nevertheless, they were still highly intelligent people. And that intelligence, that knowledge that they had, was passed on to subsequent generations, who taught it to the generations that came after them. Not only that, but as we've seen, the lifespans of people in the pre-flood era were enormous. Adam lived till he was 930. People lived till they were 7, 8, 900 years. Methuselah, 969. And I brought a chart the other week, and you can see the overlap of lives. And so the point of all that is that this first genius, Adam, was still alive when his sons, his grandsons, his great-grandsons, his great-great-grandsons, and so on and so forth, to at least about the 7th or 8th, I think 10th generation, he was still alive. And so I pointed out the other week, just imagine Sir Isaac Newton was still alive when, you know, Albert Einstein was around, and the other kind of geniuses. Imagine they were all still alive at the same time and could share information. Imagine what that pool of, and that interaction between genius individuals, imagine what that could achieve. Well, that's what you had in the pre-flood era. So the knowledge that people possessed was not only preserved, but it was passed on and it was developed as each successive generation came along, you see, through interaction between the generations. And so what we're told in Genesis chapter 4, verses 19 to 22, about the sons of Lamech, and that is the Lamech in the ungodly line of Cain, that it tells us, it describes people working as agriculturalists, rearing livestock, working with bronze and iron, making and using musical instruments, all from the earliest times of human history. In fact, it doesn't tell us the dates of the births of the sons of Cain or the deaths. But if we base the generations at a similar level to the generations in the godly line, then you're talking about a period of no more than 500 years after creation. And so you've got agriculturalists, you've got people raising and keeping livestock, you've got people working in bronze and iron, creating musical instruments and teaching them how to reflect. All that within 500 years of creation. So that's the biblical view of things. Man was intelligent from the word go. Whereas the view held by modern historians and archaeologists, who generally hold to an evolutionary world view, follows this kind of a scheme that I'm going to outline now. As far as the history of the human race is concerned, it usually divides ancient history into three main periods. You've got the Stone Age, first of all, which goes from circa 5 to 2.5 million years ago. That's when apes first started to become, you know, primitive humans. And that Stone Age goes through various different stages to the Neolithic period to round about 2500 BC. And the Stone Age is so called because people in that period of time learned how to make simple stone tools to be able to, you know, crack open the coconuts or whatever they wanted to do, you know what I mean? Simple tools. But what you've got in that whole period between 5 to 2.5 million to 2500, the whole of Stone Age period, is an evolution of man from a creature with a fairly small brain and very low intelligence, hunter-gatherers, to people who started to have a bit more intelligence. And then following the Stone Age, historians would usually say, came the Bronze Age. And that's circa 3300 BC, see there's some overlap here, 3300 BC to 1200 BC. And so the Bronze Age is a period when people started to work with bronze, and early forms of writing were developed and things like that, I think, during the later Bronze period, according to historians. And then that's followed by what they call the Iron Age. That's from around about 1200 BC to 500 BC, when people start to work with iron more, you see. And so you can look all this up and get more details off your internet if you want. And then, of course, that's followed by a number of periods where man basically is becoming more and more intelligent as time goes by. And man's evolution takes a huge leap at the time that they call the Renaissance, and that's between the period sort of 1350 AD to 1600, and it's called the beginning of the modern age. And so since the Renaissance, you've got the period of the Enlightenment, and then that takes you right through to the Industrial Revolution, modern times, and then now towards the beginning of this century, or just before, starts the digital age, when access to knowledge and information becomes, it's enormous. You know, we can basically, whatever you want, you can just Google it and you can get the information. And so the whole idea of this view is that man starts very primitive, you know, just something that's just beyond an ape, that can create very basic tools out of stone, and over millennia of development and evolution, he comes to what we are today, this highly intelligent race that have created computers and all kinds of technology. We can put satellites up in outer space and do all these kind of things. So basically, the idea is onward and upward. Onward and upward. That's the evolutionary worldview of the development, the history of the development of man. And it starts somewhere in the region of 2.5 to 5 million years ago, right up to the present time. So that view, and it's the view that is, that all the education system is based on, it's what your children will have been taught, it's what you were taught, you know, and it's what is generally accepted by people today. What I'm saying is, it runs contrary to what the Bible says. The Bible says that, Cain built a city. And this is the son of Adam. He built a city. Now, I'm not saying it was London or anything like that. I'm not saying it was New York City. I'm not saying it was an enormous city like that. What I am saying, though, is that it involved buildings. Now, what kind of a city is it if it doesn't have buildings? So it had buildings of sorts. And I think in a previous Bible study, I said it was more than a city. It was a civilization. It was a kingdom. It was a society with basic rules. You know, according to the other worldview, civilization and society doesn't develop for thousands and thousands and thousands of years after man stopped being an ape. But the Bible says, within a generation or two from Adam, you've got civilization, you've got a city, you've got a kingdom. And then, within seven generations, Lamech's sons were men who were craftsmen in bronze and iron. You get that? Both together. Not a Bronze Age for thousands of years before the Iron Age. No, they were craftsmen in bronze and iron, is what the Bible says. Is it right or is it wrong? Is the Bible right or is the historian archaeologist right? See, you and I have got to make our mind up who we want to believe about this. But it says they were craftsmen in bronze and iron. They had musical instruments and the skill to play them. Within 500 years or so of Adam being created, on what the tunes were, but they had musical instruments. They were agriculturalists and keepers of livestock. Cain, it says, built this city, which, again, was a civilization, but it had buildings. Must have had. And the point is this, you see, all these things, working in bronze and iron, making artifacts, making weapons, making ornaments, whatever you did with your bronze and iron, creating musical instruments, building buildings all require intelligence, design, craftsmanship, artistry, skill and applied knowledge, don't they? Those things don't just happen, oh, I think I'll mess about with a bit of bronze, oh, look what's come out of the fire. I mean, that's the kind of thing that happens in the day of Moses when they claim they chucked the gold in the fire and out pops a golden calf. You know, it doesn't happen that way. Somebody has to make it. And so I'm pointing out that it took intelligence, skill and artistry and craftsmanship to do the things they were doing within a few hundred years, probably less, of Adam. And so, from the earliest times, according to the Bible, man possessed great intelligence. He didn't acquire it or gain it over millennia of evolution. So that is the assertion here. And my point is that archaeology supports the biblical record as you would expect it to, wouldn't you? You know, it's interesting. Back in the 19th century, they started to dig things up. They started to dig cities up that were mentioned in the Bible. And they thought that they would disprove what the Bible said, only to discover that actually everything they dug up proved the Bible rather than disproved it. So the liberal theologian historians had to bend the evidence or reinterpret it because they didn't want to accept the Bible was true, you see. So in a minute we're going to look at a couple of examples, mainly the Great Pyramid, of things that not only support the biblical view about ancient man being a highly intelligent individual and not some kind of Neanderthal caveman who could, you know, barely think for himself, but what actually these ancient artifacts prove is that most likely he was far more intelligent than we are now. In fact, must have been, to do what he did, which is kind of, you know, a kick in the teeth to the academic unbeliever, because he likes to think he's superior in knowledge, you see. But what these things actually prove is that ancient man was more intelligent than we are. But before we look at that, I want us to first of all consider the example of the ark itself that Noah built. Now I know that if there were academics here tonight, they would say that you know, to use the ark of Noah as an example for the intelligence of ancient man is an invalid argument, because from their point of view the ark didn't exist. There was no such thing. It's just a story. Okay, so you can hardly use it as any proof, plus the fact that nobody's ever dug it up. So you can hardly use it as a proof for you know, saying that ancient man was intelligent to be able to build such a thing. But of course, to say that, the academic has to ignore certain evidence that he knows is there for the Ark of Noah that he never tells anybody else about. But if you read a book like that, and it's actually really worth reading, The Authenticity of the Book of Genesis by Bill Cooper, it's in three parts. It's a great book, a little bit academic, but in that book, in one part of it, he talks about flood legends from all over the world. Okay, so from peoples and tribes from South America to North America to China to India to Africa to Europe to the Eskimos even, all over the world, people have in their tradition a story about a flood in which a man escaped a flood and became, with his wife, the father of their people. And Bill Cooper actually describes many of these legends. Now, apart from the biblical one, right, which has total credibility, some of them are a bit daft. But that's not the point. The point is that in the distant memory of these people, most of whom had never come across the Judeo-Christian scriptures or the influence of Christianity, still have in their distant memory the memory of a flood in which one man or certain people escaped a great deluge. Don't you think that's interesting? Why should that be? That peoples from South America, North America, China, all over the world, they've got the same memory. Okay, the details are different, and some of them are kind of tantamount to almost nonsense, but the basic gist of the story is the same. Does that not say something? I think it does. It proves that there is a flood on which, and the people who came through it are the parents of the human race today that has now spread throughout the world. But you see, the modern academic says, oh, he ignores the facts of that, but it's there. But my point is simply this about the ark. When you consider, as we will, the scale of the flood and what actually occurred, that it didn't just involve, you know, bad rainfall for 40 days or whatever, but there were earthquakes, tsunamis, you know, as I say, the whole earth ripping itself apart, the ark had to be more than a big boat. In fact, the usual picture of an ark in children's storybooks is really a joke. It's an upturned bathtub with a house on top and a giraffe's head sticking out of the roof and a couple of elephants on the main deck. You know, I mean, it's a joke. The ark, if it had been anything like that at all, I doubt it would have sailed for a day. But this was not that. This was a judgment-proof vessel that kept alive all those who were inside it through the greatest catastrophe that has happened from then to now, and they all came out alive at the other side. And my point is this. I don't think we have the technology today, unless God gave us the details, humanly speaking, I don't think we have the technology today to build a vessel that could survive that kind of a catastrophe for that length of time, and everyone who was in it come out alive at the other side. Are you with me? So you could say, yeah, but Ian, that's because God gave Noah the details. True. But Noah had to build it. Noah and his sons still had to build it. And when you think about the logistical exercise, just of getting the whole project together and considering, you know, what the animals were going to eat for the length of time they were going to be in there, which was over a year, and the skill and the craftsmanship of actually making that ark, as I say, I doubt we could do that today with all our technology and with all our power tools and everything else that we've got. And that ark was built just 1600 years from creation. So ancient man was an extremely intelligent being, was he not? Even just to make that. Okay, but let's look now at a couple of examples of things that do exist, and everybody knows they are there. And I'm thinking, first of all, of the Great Pyramid of Giza. And I got some interesting facts off the internet about the Great Pyramid of Giza. I could have read your loads, but I mean, time won't allow for that. Of course, the Great Pyramid of Giza was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. In fact, it's the only one that's reasonably intact to this present time. It was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And so archaeologists and Egyptologists date the building of the Giza pyramids between 2589 to 2504 BC. And the pyramids of Giza were built, they say, over an 85-year period. Usually they say the Great Pyramid of Giza was built, it took between 20 and 30 years to build, most say 23 years. I'm not quite sure how they come to that assumption, but most say it took 23 years to build. So if the date of 2589 to 2504 BC is correct, then the Great Pyramid of Giza predates the flood, which occurred in the year 2348 BC, which is 1656 years from creation. So it would, if the date is correct, it would predate the flood. Yeah. Now you can get lots of books and lots of info off the internet on fascinating facts about the Great Pyramid. But as I say, I got some, and I just want to read some of these out to you tonight. There's loads more than this, but these struck me as particularly interesting. Bearing in mind when they say it was built, all right, just before the flood, or if you don't accept that, just after the flood, but certainly no later than that. Okay, so here's a few facts. This Great Pyramid is one of the three pyramids that were built in Giza and was the largest of all. For 3,800 years, this pyramid remained the world's tallest structure made by man. As far as the size of the Great Pyramid of Giza is concerned, its original height was 481 feet or 146.5 metres high. Experts say that it took about 23 years to complete this massive structure, and the overall weight of the structure is estimated to be around 5.9 million tonnes. The Great Pyramid's base is a perfect square, and each side of the square measuring 756 feet. The base spans over 13 acres of land and is big enough to accommodate nearly 10 football fields. Experts estimate that nearly 2.3 million stone blocks had been used to build this massive structure, with the average weight of each stone block being 7 tonnes. Some of the stone blocks were as heavy as 30 tonnes and some weighed well over 50 tonnes. And bear in mind, it's how high? 481 feet high. So you've got to get 7-ton stones, sometimes 22-ton stones, up there. How do you do that? Okay, that's one thing. When the pyramid was built, the entire structure was covered with what is known as casing stones. Casing stones were actually limestones that were extremely well polished. According to experts, some 144,000 casing stones were used. Each of these casing stones had a thickness of nearly 100 inches. These casing stones were also extremely flat, so flat that in mathematical terms, the accuracy of the stone's flatness stood at 0.01 inch of perfect straight. The average weight of each casing stone stood at 20 tons. This is just what covers it, and you've got to get that up. 481 feet, did I say? Only a few of these casing stones remain today near the base of the pyramid. The remaining were removed after a massive earthquake that took place in the 14th century that shook the pyramid and loosed the casing stones. The Arabs then ripped off the casing stones and used them for building mosques. It is said that ball and socket design of construction was used for the cornerstone foundations of the pyramid to help it deal with earthquakes and the earth's heat expansion. Scientists have been baffled by the mortar that was used for the construction of the pyramid. The mortar is way stronger than the rocks that were used, and though scientists have actually analysed the chemical composition of the mortar, they have not been able to reproduce it. The Great Pyramid is the only pyramid in the world to have slight concave faces on all four sides. Yet another baffling fact is that though we say the Great Pyramid has four sides, it actually has eight sides. On each of the four sides, there is an indentation of laser precision that divides each face into two pieces. From ground, the viewers cannot see the indentations, and hence they can only see four faces. In order to see the indentations and all eight faces of the pyramid, one needs to go aerial. And that too when the lighting conditions are perfect to make eight faces visible, and there's a picture there showing it. The eight faces of the Great Pyramid are visible only during autumn equinox and spring equinox, during dawn as well as during sunset. Those are the times when the sun casts a shadow on the pyramid, making the indentations properly visible from the earth. Inside the pyramid, the temperature is maintained at 20 degrees Celsius or 68 degrees Fahrenheit. This temperature never changes and is actually equal to the Earth's average temperature. The Great Pyramid is the last of the three pyramids that were built by Egyptians with a swivel door. However, that swivel door no longer exists in the pyramid. According to experts, the granite coffer, which is located inside the king's chamber, is so big that it would have been literally impossible to carry it inside from any of the passages of the pyramid after the construction of the pyramid was finished. Hence, experts think the coffer was actually placed there while the pyramid was still under construction. Further analysis of the coffer revealed something very interesting. The entire thing was made out of a single granite block. In order to achieve this, those ancient Egyptians would have required about 8 feet to 9 feet long saws made of bronze. Not just that, the teeth of the saw should have had sapphires fitted to cut through the granite. Even more perplexing is the fact that they would have needed tubular drills made of bronze and fitted with sapphire bits in order to hollow out the interior of the granite block. Also, these drills should have been used vertically, exerting at least 2 tons of drilling force. Experts have put the coffer under microscope to figure out that the tubular drills needed to be fixed point drills, otherwise making the coffer out of a single graphite block was literally not possible. They had drills. And this is built 2500 BC, according to the evidence. The Great Pyramid sits right on top of centre of Earth's landmass, or Earth's geographical centre. The east-west axis of the pyramid corresponds to Earth's longest land parallel. This parallel passes right through Asia, Africa and America. On the other hand, Earth's longest land meridian that is known to pass through Antarctica, Europa, Africa and Asia also runs directly through the pyramid. So the Great Pyramid of Giza is actually the place where the parallel and meridian intersects each other. The only way the Earth's surface can endure the massive weight of the Great Pyramid is if there is a solid mountain made solely of rock lying beneath the Great Pyramid under the surface. Well, that's actually what it is. A solid flat mountain of granite lies right beneath the surface of the Earth where the Great Pyramid stands. When compared to the Empire State Building, the Great Pyramid is 30 times bigger than the building. Put in other words, the total material used for the Great Pyramid can be used for building 30 Empire State Buildings. Returning back to the casing stones that we spoke of earlier, each of these stones were cut out at nearly perfect right angles on all 6 sides. On top of that, each of these casing stones were placed with a gap of 0.02. This gap was not accidental, it was rather intentional. The space or gap between the two casing stones was meant for the glue that held the casing stones together. Interesting, the technology of the 21st century is incapable of achieving greater accuracy with 20-ton stones than what was already achieved with the casing stones of the Great Pyramid. As we mentioned earlier, each of the 4 sides of the pyramid are concave and the indentation is visible only from the earth. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And the point I'm making is that built into the pyramid, into the core of it, mathematics and astronomical features, the radius of the sun, one of its inner chambers points to a certain constellation of Orion that was only visible in 2400 and something. It's just incredible. And the question that it raises is simply this. If the ancient Egyptians could build that, then they must have had knowledge and technology that surpasses what we have today. Because today we don't know how they did it. It says here, the pyramid encodes the fractal speed of light, the precise measurements of the Earth's curvature and the radius, the sun's radius, average continent height, average temperature of Earth and other geological, mathematical and astronomical information. A culture so ancient knew about all this information and actually put them together in a single structure. That is something that is difficult to digest. But what is your alternative than to believe that the ancient Egyptians did that? What's your alternative? Extraterrestrial, superintelligent beings did it? Some people suggest that, you know, super giant Nephilim actually move the stones. And if you go on the internet, there's all kinds of bizarre suggestions. But my point is simply this. If you have a biblical worldview, then whilst you won't understand how they did it, what you will understand is ancient man was extremely intelligent and was not only capable, not only had all that information and understood all that stuff, but he was capable of actually building it. Some people say it must have taken millions of people, slaves, to put the Great Pyramid of Giza together. Actually, the bloke who wrote this article pointed something out. I probably can't find it. Oh, it's here. This is interesting. It says, they say it took 23 years to complete the pyramid. It says, 23 years. Some say it took 30, some say 20. There is a small problem here. 2.5 million blocks of stone, each weighing anywhere between 7 and 50 tons, cut with laser precision. It would literally take one such stone block to be fit every 2.5 minutes for 7 days every week for 365 days a year, continuously for 23 years to do it. And then it says, and some people say, it took millions and millions of slaves to put it all together. But historians estimate that at that point in time, there were only between 3 and 7 million people alive on Earth. So in other words, that was done, and we know not how. But ancient man must have been extremely intelligent. I'm running out of time here, but I came across this other building, and it's in Peru. And the place is called Sacsahuaman. And it's located in Peru. And the point is that this building contains stones, and they were cut miles away from the building and dragged from where they were cut down through a swamp and then fitted together in the structure. And these stones, many of them are quite unusual shapes. They're not like just like bricks, you know. They're quite unusual shapes. And yet they fit together perfectly. And the point is, and I've got a picture of a guy with his wife standing next to one of them. And some of, in fact, I was just going to read this little paragraph from this book that's worth hearing. Get this. He says, some of the stones used in the building of Sacsahuaman were quite large. In the photograph, for example, my wife, daughter and I are standing in front of a stone estimated to weigh in excess of 100 tons. That is a large stone. However, another even larger stone is located in the area. Concerning this larger stone, one writer comments. He says, what is truly impossible about the block is that it is the size of a 5-story house and weighs an estimated 20,000 tons. We have no combination of machinery today that could dislodge such a weight, let alone move it any distance. The fact that the builders of Sacsahuaman could and did move this block shows their mastery of a technology which we have not yet attained. Mm-hmm. Now the thing is that Sacsahuaman is from the Inca civilization, and that's only sort of 1400 and something AD, something like that. So that's relatively recent. And yet that technology has been lost. So the question is, where did that technology come from? And I would suggest to you that it came with their descendants through the flood from the most ancient of times that they retained. We can't do it today. And the whole point of this Bible study is this, you see. Because next week we're going to come back to our proper passage and we'll look at the life of Enoch. But the point is this, you see. There is a view that's been held for probably about the last 100, 150 years or so amongst modern man. That if you can only educate people better and give them more information and more knowledge and give children more access to learning and to education, then a lot of the evils in society will disappear. And that people will see that war is just ridiculous. It's just a pointless exercise and causes nothing but suffering. What the world needs, they say, is more education. And the more intelligent we become, the more knowledgeable we become, the better the world will be. And that view was especially held at the turn of the last century. You know, that is to say 1900, that sort of a period of time. Because actually beginning in 1851 with the Great Exhibition in London, organised by Prince Albert in the Crystal Palace, you know, this was an exhibition of world technology. So people came and exhibited from all over the world. And such was the success of that exhibition, albeit Crystal Palace burned down, of course, that similar exhibitions were held in various places all over the world. And the view, and it was like a showcase for new technologies and new inventions that were coming along. So by the year 1900, people genuinely believed that man had evolved and developed to such a state where he was about to create his own utopia, that there'd be an end to war, because all these new inventions and all these new things would make life so much better for everyone that people would see there's no need for fighting, there's no reason for war, and we'd all live happy, fruitful lives, and man would create his own utopia. The First World War was the First War fought, they say, on an industrial scale. So all that technology was used for destruction. Yeah. And so within a 4-year period, the idea that man through his own intelligence was going to create a utopia died in that war. Yeah. But here we are today, 100 years on, and actually man again thinks that because of the leaps that he's made, especially since the digital era began, that we're going to do it again. We're going to actually create. Man is going to create a fine desert. If we can just get through this climate change stuff, you know, and we can just save the planet over the next 50 years, then with the inventions and with the increase in knowledge, man is going to create a utopia. But you see, the point is this, and what history proves, and what the time before the flood proves, is that with increasing knowledge, and with increasing intelligence, doesn't necessarily come increase in good behaviour, does it? Morality doesn't always accompany an increase in knowledge. In fact, it rather goes the other way. The more man invents, the more he invents his doom, basically. Because whatever man invents, he always turns it into an evil. And if we need any proof of that, we've just got to look at the internet. Which is fantastic, but it's also a great evil. Isn't it? And that's man. And so, as in the days of Noah, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. What's all that got to do with what we looked at tonight? Increase in technology, increase in knowledge goes alongside increase of wickedness, and that's what we're seeing in our generation.